And then it says, may your vow to benefit all sentient beings now ripen for myself and others. So the medicine Buddha, before he attained enlightenment, when he first generated bodhicitta, made certain vows. And you'll find in the scriptures different Buddhas you have recorded when they first generated bodhicitta, when they first got that spontaneous, unmitigated, fully engaged compassion and determination to become a Buddha to benefit all beings, not just everybody they like, but everybody. Then at that time they often made certain vows and pledges, say, because they have such strong, altruism at that time. When I'm a Buddha, may da 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 happen. Okay? And so their vows are recorded down, and it's, say here, may your vow to benefit all sentient beings ripen, upon us and everybody else. And so there's a copy in your folder, I think, of the 12 vows of the Medicine Buddha. And in the next upcoming days, I'll go through those a little bit. I'm sure there's some button pushers in there, one in particular. I can't imagine why. We all know which one it is without saying the name. Number 8. Somebody has a good sense of humor. I'm going to teach Anne how to laugh then. Okay, so we'll be talking about these the next few days. I'll let you stew in it a little bit right now. And the men shouldn't feel smug because you too can be born a woman, isn't it? And then you can wiggle and understand. Okay. But we're thinking of the power of those vows. Number 11 was to relieve the hunger and thirst. That one we don't have any problems with at all, do we? Okay? And so it's kind of putting our energy behind the aspirations of the Medicine Buddha. Okay? Same with these wonderful vows, these wonderful aspirations that he has to eliminate the suffering of the various beings. We too want to be able to do like that. Okay? And so may this actually come about. In other words, with the vows he's made, may it actually happen for us personally and for everybody else. Okay? The Medicine Buddha, when he first generated bodhicitta, before he was a Buddha, when he generated that wish to become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings, then he made certain pledges or certain vows that enabled him to fulfill have kind of a speciality. It's like I was saying before, all the Buddhas have the same realizations. They can all manifest as each other. But when you're on the path before you've gotten to the result, if you make special vows and promises, then kind of while you're on the path and after you become a Buddha, you have a special force and a karmic link with sentient beings in a certain way. Okay. For example, Shakyamuni Buddha, when he generated bodhicitta, really prayed to be able to manifest in the world in a degenerate age. And so ours is considered a degenerate age. and he was able to manifest and teach the Dharma, you know, and have the force that he did because of the vows that he generated at the time that he initially generated bodhicitta. So this generation of bodhicitta is it's a really heartfelt thing, and it's quite an advanced realization. So when we are generating bodhicitta all the time, okay? For example, when we do the prayers and we say, you know, by the positive potential of practicing generosity and the other far-reaching attitudes, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. That's the time when we're generating bodhicitta. Now, are we really generating bodhicitta? Okay, there's fabricated and unfabricated bodhicitta. Ours is fabricated, okay? It's artificial. If you do things enough artificially, eventually you'll do them spontaneously. Okay? If you don't ever try, then you never get there. It's kind of like when you're little, how you dress up. You know, you put on mom and dad's clothes and you pretend to be a doctor. And, well, we didn't pretend to be computer experts when I was little. But some of you young ones may have. you know, but you pretend to be something, and then that gives you the ability to become that. Okay? So we generate bodhicitta in that artificial way as a way of constantly putting that seed inside of our mind that this is what we want to actually get to in a spontaneous way. Okay? Now, just saying the prayer alone isn't enough to eventually get us to spontaneous love and compassion for others. So we also need to do all the long rim meditations, which is this whole set of meditations that we started on today, beginning with equanimity, seeing the kindness of others, remembering they were our mother, kind as our parents, wanting to repay it. All these, you know, meditations are the ones that we do, that, and we do them repeatedly because, you know, they have this transformative effect on our mind. So at the end, you know, one day we'll actually become bodhisattvas because of them. So we also have to purify our mind, create positive potential, study, you know, do these meditations. But the cause and effect function, so if we create the causes, then one day too, we'll be able to generate bodhicitta for the first time. That first time is when you actually enter the path. Okay? In the Mahayana path. That first time is what we talk sometimes of five paths in the Mahayana path. Generating bodhicitta, you know, like that, the spontaneous, unfabricated kind, is when you actually enter the first of the five paths. And that's when your three countless great eons begins. Okay? They say on the Mahayana path it takes three countless great eons of creating positive potential and, you know, meditating on wisdom to finally become a Buddha. The tantric path is quicker, you know, but that's when it all begins. Huh? So that's a good place to get to. Yeah. And it's a very valuable place, because once we have that bodhicitta, then because the mind is so transformed, whenever we see any person, our spontaneous feeling is, you know, I want to become a Buddha to be able to benefit them most. Yeah? Now imagine having that be the spontaneous feeling you have whenever you see somebody else. Yeah? Pretty different than how we are now, isn't it? Okay. But you can see that if we train our minds in this, yeah, and even train our mind on a day-to-day basis, every time you look at somebody, you think, I want to become a Buddha in order to benefit that person. Yeah. But if you train your mind like this, then your whole perception of other sentient beings changes. Mm-hmm. And that's why they say that our generation of bodhicitta depends on each and every living being. Now, last session we were talking about this thing about feeling like we want to be independent, like we don't depend on anybody. Even to become a Buddha, we're dependent on sentient beings. okay? Because it's only by generating this kind of love and compassion for them that we can become sentient beings. It's not like, here I am, I'm independent from all these lonely critters. Yeah. But we generate our love and compassion and dependence on them. Okay, so it's a whole process of transforming the mind to really, like I said, so we have that vision whenever we see somebody, that aspiration, and so that also we're transforming our mind so that others' happiness becomes more important than our own happiness. It's a big transformation, huh? But when we can do that, we're going to be happier. Because if you look at the happiness that the bodhisattvas experience and the happiness that we experience, who's happier? Okay, the bodhisattvas are happier, aren't they? Yeah, much greater happiness than we have. Okay, but we cherish ourselves more than others, and they cherish others more than themselves. So whose method works? Yeah. I mean, it's rather shocking, isn't it? Yeah. That we're, day to day, as ordinary beings, we're practicing a method that does not work. Yeah. And we're thinking that it works. Because we think the more we look out for our own happiness, the more we're going to be happy. Because if I don't look out for me, nobody else in this big bad world is going to. But the actual result is, the more I look out for my own happiness, the more miserable I am.
Do you really believe that?
Why? Why am I more miserable because I look out for my own happiness? Well, number one, when I look out for my own happiness, I try and get everything I want and destroy everything I don't like. So in the process of doing that, I create a lot of negative actions. You know, I badmouth people, I cheat people, I lie, I do all sorts of stuff to get what I want and get away from everything I don't want. So I create all those negative actions weapon of my own unhappiness. Yeah. Whenever we create a negative action, we have self-centeredness as a prime motivator. You know, we never say, for the benefit of all sentient beings, I'm going to harm somebody. You know. Yeah, we never do that. It's always for the benefit of me, I'm going to trash someone. Yeah. So whenever we experience suffering, okay, look this one. Whenever we experience suffering, any kind of suffering, from stubbing your toe to, you know, whatever it is, it's all due to self-centeredness on our own part. Because all of our suffering comes from our own negative actions, and all of our negative actions were created under the force of self-centeredness. Yeah? Because when we have a mind that genuinely cherishes others, we never create negative actions. So this is a big one, you know, when you live your life and every little thing, you know, I don't like the weather today. This weather stinks. You know, why? Why am I unhappy? My own self-centeredness. You know, not only do I create the karma to be born in the Pacific Northwest, where it rains all summer, not to be born, but to move here, you know, where it rains all summer. But also, you know, my own self-centeredness is so involved in thinking about my pleasure that all of a sudden the weather becomes a big deal. Okay? So you can see two ways that self-centeredness creates problems for us. One is that it makes us create the karma that influences the situation we find ourselves in. The other is that it influences how we interpret the present situation we're in. Okay? So somebody else could walk in here and say,
wow, it's so beautiful and green with the rain, and I love the gray, and I just came from the Negev desert, and this is fantastic here. Yeah? And that person's blissed out. Me, with my complaining mind, is like, oh, I can't stand the Negev, and I can't stand this either. Okay? So that kind of mind just makes you miserable. You know, everywhere you go, you're unhappy. Another way the self-centeredness makes us miserable is that we interpret everything that happens to us in a very particular way, and we become super sensitive to everything. Yeah? You ever notice that, how we become very sensitive, how somebody looks at us? You know, are they really smiling, or do they want something out of me? You know, do they like me? Do I fit in this group? You know, all the time is kind of ruminating. Yeah? So we pay attention to ourselves in a negative way due to the self-centeredness. Okay? So remember I was talking about, you know, negative and positive ways of paying attention to ourselves? Yes, in our Dharma practice, we're trying to develop a positive way of paying attention to ourselves and pull us out of the self-centered way. Because it just doesn't work. Yeah, it makes us so super sensitive to everything everybody does. Yeah. And I think we've all had the experience where it's a flip situation, where your friend is upset with you because of something you said and you don't even remember it. You ever had that happen? You know? You said something completely from your side, totally innocuous. Your friend took it very seriously and was really upset. I don't even remember. Well, you know, we do that too. Totally misinterpret what other people say, project all this stuff on them. Yeah, get really angry, make ourselves miserable, make them miserable, and it's all due to the self-centered attitude. One time I was giving a talk in Woodinville High School, this was many years ago, and one boy, I guess he grew up in an evangelical Christian family, kind of pulled me to the side after the talk, and he said, "Do Buddhists believe in the devil?" And I said, well, we don't believe in any kind of external devil, but for us, our biggest harmful force is our own self-centeredness, our own self-preoccupation. Yeah? So if you look at it this way, you know, other sentient beings are only kind. The whole reason we get unhappy is because of the self-preoccupation. Because if we do these meditations, looking at the kindness of others, all the time, people are giving so much to us. All the time. Yeah. And this really fits in with the discussion about learning to receive. You know, half the time we aren't even aware of receiving things. We just take it for granted and assume the world owes us something. But the more, you know, we become aware of how much we receive from others all the time, and how much kindness there is in the world, and how dependent we are on others, you know, and how much we receive, then we only see goodness when we look at others. Yeah. What makes us see yuckiness is our own self-preoccupation, the mind that says, well, what about me? You know, I'm an important one here. How come this isn't happening because I want it to happen? So, again, don't misinterpret. I'm not saying we should do everything everybody else wants. Yeah. I'm not saying that we, you know, just think of others and whatever they want to do, we go along with it. My brother's an alcoholic. He wants to go out drinking. Sure, I'll go along with him because that's how I can be generous and he wants to give to me, so that's how I'll receive and we'll connect really well. I'm not talking about that, okay? Yeah, we have to have wisdom in this whole thing of giving and receiving. And we have to clearly discern what's self-centered and what is really for the benefit of others, and not mix them up. Okay? Remember I was talking about being a people pleaser? When we're a people pleaser, we think we're doing it for the benefit of others, but we're really doing it for our own benefit. Okay? And, you know, sometimes somebody wants to do something that's harmful, and for their benefit, because we care about them more than ourselves, we might have to say something that's very painful to them. But they're not going to like one iota. But it's coming from a compassionate place inside of us that knows that that's the best thing for the other person. And we're willing to bear their dislike and their anger. Imagine that. Yeah? I think parents know it a little bit. Yeah, those of you who are parents, sometimes you know you have to say something to your kid that they ain't gonna like. No way. Yeah? But you do it because you love your child. And you know they're gonna be mad at you, but you know, you're willing to bear their anger because you love them, and you know that your advice is the best thing for them. Okay? So, you know, if we can enlarge that scope and feel that way towards other living beings, have that same kind of love for them that you have for your own child, and be willing to bear, you know, what parents go through to raise us, then, you know, but then you take out the attachment part of the parent-child relationship, okay? You take that part out. But then you put, you know, you keep that same kind of selflessness in there and extend that to all living beings in an equal way. And when you're a parent, you get up in the middle of the night to take care of your 2-year-old who's throwing up. Yeah. You don't expect your 2-year-old to go, thank you, Mom, thank you, Dad. You know, you're so kind. And, you know, I know you're sacrificing your sleep to take care of me. You know, you don't expect that, do you? Yeah. But you help them anyway. Huh? If we could take that kind of willingness to help and lack of expectation and extend that to other living beings when we help them. It's quite something when you think about it, isn't it? Yeah? But we, you know, we practice this just little by little, and we keep kind of trying to stretch ourselves, you know, to keep stretching ourselves. How many of you are parents? Ah, a number of you. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah? And then if you can take that, really, give it to others. Okay, so when we say that a bodhisattva cherishes others more than self, again, it doesn't mean that, and I say this because we so often think that then we have to be crucified. Yeah, we hear cherish others more than yourself, and you think of this. Can't even do that right. Now you see why they won't let women in. I'm joking. But we get, you know, we shouldn't have this feeling that in order to cherish others more than self, we have to be miserable. Because the first bodhisattva Bhumi, yeah, The bunnies are different than the paths, the grounds. We're talking about the 10 grounds. The 10 grounds, the first one is called the very joyful. Okay? That bodhisattva is so happy all the time. Yeah. That bodhisattva is millions of times happier than an arhat. Even though an arhat is out of cyclic existence, and that bodhisattva isn't necessarily out of cyclic existence, you know, that bodhisattva is millions of times happier than the arhat. Because their whole attention, you know, they cherish others more than self. Okay, so as a bodhisattva, you're happy, you're miserable. If you're miserable all the time, how can you work for others' benefit? Yeah? If you feel like, you know, oh, I have to sacrifice myself and it hurts so much and this is so miserable and look what I'm doing for you. You know, if you kind of have the Jewish mother complex. You know? I hope you're not taking this one, Julie. Then, you know, how are you going to work for the benefit of sentient beings? Yeah? If you're always feeling, oh, this is so painful for me to do, I'm sacrificing myself so much for you because I care so much for you and I hope you realize how miserable I am doing it. Yeah. That is not a bodhisattva attitude. Okay? So a bodhisattva is so delighted to help others. Yeah. They say when a bodhisattva hears that somebody else wants something, you know, that somebody else wants even part of their body, you know, wants a kidney or an arm or a leg or an eyeball or, you know, they just even hear it in the prospect of being able to give their own body. They're like so blissed out. Okay? So this is the kind of transformation we're trying to make in our own mind. Yeah? Where the affection for others is so strong that giving to them becomes a joy. Yeah? It's not a sacrifice, but it feels like a privilege and a joy. So it's a good reminder to us, you know, every time we have the opportunity to give and our mind is going, yeah, okay. Then to say, you know, a bodhisattva would be really happy right now. Yeah? Now would we rather be happy or rather be miserable? You watch your misery. We're attached to our misery, you know, it's very familiar, why give it up? You know, but to say, you know, it's only my mind that's making me miserable right now. Yeah? I could have a happy mind and do this with a happy mind. Because yeah? Bodhisattvas would be happy doing this. Okay, so this is the kind of thing we're aiming at, the kind of training that we're trying to do with our mind. You know, it's a very deep transformation, isn't it? You know, because from day one, who we've been thinking about? Me. Yeah? So it this involves a lot of retraining our mind. Reforming our attitudes. Yeah. But the thing is, if we practice it slowly, slowly, and we keep on doing it, it's definitely going to happen because cause and effect works. Yeah. And if you create the causes and you put your energy in this direction, you know, that happens. Okay. So, I didn't put my glasses on. The Buddha told Manjushri, if you go eastward beyond as many Buddha fields as there are 10 times the number of grains of sand in the Ganges River, you will find a realm known as pure lapis lazuli.
The Buddha there is known as Master of Healing, the lapis lazuli radiance Tathagata, Arhat, perfectly enlightened one, perfect in mind and deed, well gone, he who knows the world, unsurpassed being, tamer of the passions, teacher of the devas and humans, Buddha and Lord. Okay, Manjushri, when that Buddha, Lord Master of Healing, the lapis lazuli radiance Tathagata, first set out on the Bodhisattva path, he made 12 vows to enable all sentient beings to obtain that which they seek. Okay, and so now we have the 12 vows. Actually, something that's good in our meditation practice, sometimes we're very, very moved when we see a certain kind of suffering or whatever. It's good at that time, you know, even at our level, to say, you know, when I become a bodhisattva, when I become a Buddha, may I be able to eliminate the suffering of those beings, you know, whichever specific ailment it is that or suffering that they have. So even now, you know, generate those kinds of aspirations. And, you know, a lot of times it has to do with what you see in your work or the kinds of things, you know, that you deal with on a day-to-day basis. You know, Rebecca's a hospice nurse, and she may say, when I become a Buddha, may I be able to help sentient beings die peacefully and be born in Buddha fields. You know, because she sees this day in and day out in her work. And you work as a drug counselor, and you might think, when I become a Buddha, may I be able to help all the people who are whacked out on drugs, you know, and lead them to happiness. So, you know, according to your work, according to the kind of people you deal with, you may have, you know, very strong feelings of really wanting to be able to help much more than you're capable of helping right now. And it's good to make those strong determinations. So the first great vow. I vow that when I attain unexcelled complete enlightenment in a future age, a radiant light will blaze forth from my body. It will brilliantly illumine limitless, countless, boundless realms. This body will be excellently adorned with the 32 marks of the great man and the 80 secondary marks. I will cause all sentient beings to wholly resemble me. Okay. So imagine, you know, being able to fulfill this vow and having this kind of radiant body that illumines, you know, countless realms and brings joy and bliss to others just by, you know, your own radiance, your own splendor. And we say, be able to cause countless sentient beings to resemble me. You know, imagine just by your physical appearance being able to inspire people to want to practice the Dharma, to want to create the causes of happiness. Yeah? I mean, imagine that by the power of your prayers, you know, and putting that energy out, you walk in a room and other people all of a sudden, their suffering lifts, and all of a sudden they become interested in the spiritual path. Yeah? You haven't even said anything. But somehow, because of the training you've done, because of your compassion and the way you've directed your energy, you put that vibe out. And you see sometimes we meet people. Yeah? I mean, like His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I mean, it's quite amazing the kind of effect he has on people. He walks in a room and, like, people start crying and they don't even know why. You know, Lama Yeshe had that same effect. Now I'm going to cry. But, you know, he would walk in the room and somehow, some, you know, there was something amazing, you know. And so you meet some people like that automatically, You know, something about them makes a shift in your own mind. And it's not like, you know, you get chills up and down and you go, you know, but it's like somehow, you know, your mind becomes more virtuous. This is what they call receiving the blessing, you know. Your mind somehow becomes interested in something positive, becomes more virtuous. Huh? Yeah.
I recall all sentient beings who wholly resemble me.
Mm-hmm.
And you just said that, if I'm hearing you right, that what that means is that when they see him, they will be interested in studying with them. I mean, he's not going to walk in and turn everybody into a group, right?
Right. Yeah, it takes a while for them to practice. Yeah. Well, you know, when bodhisattvas make vows like this, and when they make prayers, they pray for things that are totally impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And they vow things that are totally impossible, but it's okay to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because your compassion is so strong that you want to be able to do that. Okay? It doesn't matter. See, the thing is, you know, the medicine board is going to walk in the room, and some people are going to go, oh, you know, I'm so bored. And then Lama Yeshe would walk in the room, and some people would go, who is this guy? You know, I want to get out of here. So it isn't like the process of having this kind of effect on people. It isn't just from the side of the Buddha or Bodhisattva, it depends on the receptivity of the individual sentient beings. Okay? So a lot of what we're trying to do when we practice is to make ourselves receptive vessels. We may have met lots of Buddhas in our life, but not even recognized them. Okay? So, from the Buddha's side, it sounds like, you know, may I walk in the room and wham or bang them, and they all have blue radiant bodies holding an aurora plant in a begging bowl. That's what it sounds like. Yeah. Now, the thing is, what he's meaning is, you know, my compassion is so strong for sentient beings that I want that to be able to happen. Whether it's possible or not, I don't care. You know? But I want sentient beings to be free of suffering so badly that I want that to be able to happen. And for them resembling, when he says, you know, may they really resemble me, it doesn't mean may they all have blue bodies, okay? But it means, you know, the mind, you know? May I meet other sentient beings on the path so that their minds resemble my mind as a Buddha. Okay? Huh? I mean, you see this kind of thing in the language often. It makes it sound like it's gonna, you know, instantaneous. Or like, you know, you'll see it later on, you know. Somebody hears the name of the medicine Buddha once and they're never gonna be reborn in the lower realms. You know, what does hear the name of the medicine Buddha once mean? Okay, it doesn't mean you hear, you know, medicine good and that's it, you know. What does hear the name mean? You have to think about that, okay. But the thing is, from the side of the bodhisattva, there's so much more sentient beings to be happy that they say, may they just even hear my name, and all of a sudden this kind of virtue arises in their mind. Okay? So you pray and you aspire for totally impossible, extravagant things. And you're willing to put in all the energy. What it does by doing that is it makes your mind very, very strong so that you're willing to go through all the ups and downs and craziness that you have to go through to help other sentient beings. It doesn't mean, you know, that Medicine Buddha walks in the room and, you know, you haven't been blissed out, so you go, you know, this stupid sentient beings I walk in the room and they aren't even blissed out, you know. They're too busy playing Nintendo. Yeah. But, you know, they make these kind of pledges as a way of signifying their determination to hang in there with sentient beings. Okay? Because imagine what you have to do to get a sentient being to not be born in the lower realms by just hearing your name. Yeah, you have to do a lot of work. Okay, second one. I vow that when I attain enlightenment in a future age, my body will be like lapis lazuli, within and without, bright with penetrating and flawless purity. The radiance will be of great merit and will be imposing indeed. My body will be an excellent and tranquil dwelling, adorned with an, how do you say that, aureola?
Aureola.
Aureola, like a glowing net, surpassing the sun and moon in its radiance. I will show the dawn to those beings who are completely concealed in darkness, so that they may act in accordance with their desired paths. Yeah? I think that's so beautiful, you know, may my body become a dwelling. Yeah? If you read in Transforming the Heart, when Geshe Tekchel talks about the taking and giving meditation, and he talks about transforming your body into the four great elements that constitute the earth, and then you give your body like you're giving the elements, and it can become whatever other sentient beings need. It's that kind of feeling. Okay. Instead of this is my body, yeah, I cherish my body, don't do anything to my body, yeah, to just, you know, may I give it away? May it become a dwelling. Okay? And then I will show the dawn. Okay, to those beings who are completely concealed in darkness. The darkness there is the darkness of ignorance. Yeah? Showing the dawn is teaching them, you know, specifically teaching them about emptiness, beginning to illumine their own mind with the correct view. Okay? So that they may act in accordance with their desired path. But what that means is that sentient beings have different dispositions, different tendencies. Yeah? And may, when, you know, what Medicine Bear is saying, when I become a Buddha, may I be able to tune in to where people are at so well that I can teach them exactly what they need according to their disposition and their interest. Yeah? So may I become a Christian teacher for those who need Christianity, and may I become a Jewish teacher for those who need Judaism. Hmm? Whatever it is, however it is, that it's skillful to guide sentient beings according to where they're at that particular moment, may I manifest in that way to be able to do that, and then slowly over many, many lifetimes guide them and place them in the path that leads to enlightenment. Okay. It's quite beautiful, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. So let's now do our prayers. We'll have the rest of the session in silent meditation. What I want you to do in the silent meditation is either think about this thing I was saying about how a bodhisattva cherishes others more than self, and how that sense of doing things is like how a parent does something for their child, and try and cultivate that kind of compassion for other beings, but like a parent has for their child. So either meditate like that, thinking of specific people and specific examples and trying to change your mind and imagine what would it feel like to have that kind of compassion and be able to help them with that much joy and that much ease. Okay? So pretend in your mind, try and role play in this and generate that. And then, you know, do that for a while, and then if you still have some time, then contemplate these vows a little bit. And try and generate this meaning and the feeling of these vows in your own mind so that you feel, I can make those same vows. I want to have that same import on sentient beings when I become a Buddha. Okay? So try and change your own attitude, uplift it, imagine what it would feel like to have that kind of compassion where you can do this. Okay? And again, use situations from your life as a testing ground. Huh? Do you get what I mean? Okay.